Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So today we're going to look at sutta number 45 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Chula Dhamma Samadana Sutta, the shorter discourse on the ways of undertaking things. And this sutta contains one of the very famous similes that the Buddha gave for sensual pleasures. And it's a sutta which needs to be read somewhat in the context of the Buddha's time and the teachings that were available at that time and the teachings that were being given by other spiritual teachers. Remembering that at the time the Buddha was teaching, he was one of many well-known teachers who were teaching different paths of spiritual practice, with sometimes similar sorts of outlooks, that is that there's more than one lifetime and that we have a series of births and deaths, and so what we do in this life is going to affect not only this lifetime but future lifetimes as well. There were also teachings about the effect of our actions in producing happiness or unhappiness for ourselves, but there were also teachings which denied that there was any cause and effect in our life, so that things were either preordained or just happening accidentally, and there was no way in which we could decide on the direction that we wanted our life to take. So when the Buddha was teaching, he would often be answering questions posed by other spiritual wanderers or people who were practicing with other teachers and who were coming from a particular perspective, wanting to compare what the Buddha was saying with what their own teachers had said to them. And so today's sutta, as we go through, I will refer to another sutta which we looked at or we heard from this particular wanderer previously, Satchika. We're going to look at one of the parts of the discussion that he had with the Buddha on some of these points, and just in the way that the Buddha gives this teaching, you will see as we go through it that he refers to the teachings and practices of some other spiritual wanderers. And when we see that, we should realize, especially looking at it from our perspective, that we don't limit this teaching just to those who are spiritual teachers, but those who are practitioners, so that we can see the relevance of this teaching in our own life now. So we'll start by going through. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, venerable sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this. Because there are four ways of undertaking things. What are the four? There is a way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain. There is a way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain. There is a way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure. There is a way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure. What bhikkhus is the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain? Because there are certain recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. There is no harm in sensual pleasures. They take to gulping down sensual pleasures and divert themselves with women wanderers who wear their hair bound in a topknot. And wearing the hair bound in a topknot is one of the traditional distinguishing features of spiritual practitioners even today in India for both males and females. They say thus, what future fear do these good recluses and Brahmins see in sensual pleasures when they speak of abandoning sensual pleasures and describe the full understanding of sensual pleasures? Pleasant is the touch of this woman wanderer's tender, soft, downy arm. Thus they take to gulping down sensual pleasures, and having done so on the dissolution of the body, after death they reappear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. There they feel painful, racking, piercing feelings. They say thus, this is the future fear those good recluses and Brahmins saw in sensual pleasures when they spoke of abandoning sensual pleasures and described the full understanding of sensual pleasures. For it is by reason of sensual pleasures, owing to sensual pleasures, that we are now feeling painful, racking, piercing feelings. So this is the first teaching that the Buddha is giving, and the Buddha is talking about those recluses and Brahmins who see no harm in sensual pleasures. And the illustration of this, how these wanderers, even though they have left the home life, still indulge in sensual pleasures, the Buddha gives the most obvious example is that they still engage in sexual intercourse. They still engage in sensuality, which is bound up with the home life, even though they have undertaken the life of a spiritual wanderer, a renunciate, and that they question why it is that the Buddha talks about sensual pleasures being something that are not helpful, that are harmful, that do not conduce to the spiritual life. And we'll just read through the simile which the Buddha gives, which is one of the most well-known similes that he gives for the danger of sensual pleasures, and then I will elaborate on that from the perspective of the Buddha's teaching. Bhikkhus, suppose that in the last month of the hot season, a maluva creeper pod burst open and a maluva creeper pod seed fell at the foot of a sala tree. Then a deity living in that tree became fearful, perturbed and frightened. But the deity's friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives, garden deities, park deities, tree deities and deities inhabiting medicinal herbs, grass and forest monarch trees gathered together and reassured that deity thus, "Have no fear, sir, have no fear. Perhaps a peacock will swallow the maluva creeper seed, or a wild animal will eat it, or a forest fire will burn it, or a woodsman will carry it off, or white ants will devour it, or maybe it may not even be fertile. But no peacock swallowed that seed, no wild animal ate it, no forest fire burned it, no woodsman carried it off, no white ants devoured it, and it was in fact fertile. Then, being moistened by rain from a rain-bearing cloud, the seed in due course sprouted, and the maluva creeper's tender, soft, downy tendril wound itself around that sala tree. Then the deity living in the sala tree thought, what future fear did my companions and friends, kinsmen and relatives, see in that maluva creeper seed when they gathered together and reassured me as they did? Pleasant is the touch of that maluva creeper's tender, soft, downy tendril. So the deity still feels that the soft touch is very pleasant. Then the creeper enfolded the sala tree, made a canopy over it, draped a curtain all around it, and split the main branches of the tree. The deity who lived in the tree then realized this is the future fear they saw in that maluva creeper seed. Because of that maluva creeper, I am now feeling painful, racking, piercing feelings. So too, bhikkhus, there are certain recluses and brahmins whose doctrine and view is that there is no harm in sensual pleasures. They say thus, this is the future fear those good recluses and brahmins saw in sensual pleasures, that we are now feeling painful, racking, piercing feelings. This is called the way of understanding, undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain. So from the simile, you can see that there is this very tiny seed compared to the size of the big sala tree. It seems to pose no threat. And there's always this thought, well, maybe the seed won't ripen. Maybe it's not fertile, maybe something will destroy it. And yet, in fact, none of those things happen, and so the seed, which is fertile and is then moistened by rain, grows and continues to grow until it takes over the tree and then, in fact, destroys the tree. And relating this to the sensual pleasures, the Buddha said that to fully understand sensual pleasures is to understand the gratification in sensual pleasures, but also to realize the danger in sensual pleasures. And so if I just refer to a sutta, another sutta, Sutta 13, the Greater Discourse on the Mass of Suffering, verse number 7, where the Buddha talks about sensual pleasures. And what, bhikkhus, is the gratification in the case of sensual pleasures? Bhikkhus, there are these five chords of sensual pleasure. What are these five? Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likeable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. Sounds cognizable by the ear, odours cognizable by the nose, flavours cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likeable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. These are the five chords of sensual pleasure. Now the pleasure and joy that arise dependent on these five chords of sensual pleasure are the gratification in the case of sensual pleasures. So the Buddha is not saying that there is no pleasure to be gained from sensuality and from indulging in these the gratification of the senses. If there was no pleasure to be gained, then people would not be bound to the wheel of birth and death. It's because there is pleasure to be gained that there is the pursuit of sensuality. And if we go on further to just the next verse, and what, bhikkhus, is the danger in the case of sensual pleasures? Here, bhikkhus, on account of the craft by which a clansman makes a living, he has to face cold, he has to face heat, he's injured by contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, and creeping things. He risks death by hunger and thirst. Now, this is the danger in the case of sensual pleasures. A mass of suffering visible here and now, having sensual pleasures as its cause, sensual pleasures as its source, sensual pleasures as its basis, the cause being simply sensual pleasures. That is, if we want to be able to indulge in sensual pleasure, we want to be able to have the things that we like to eat and be surrounded by the things that we like to hear and see, that touch. We want to have air conditioning when it's hot and heating when it's cold. If we want to be able to organise our life the way that we want it to be, then we have to go out to work. And that's this person who's going out is then subject to all the dangers of going out to work. So these days we may not think about that in terms of physical danger, although some people do actually put their life on the line as they go out to work, intentionally or unintentionally. But there's all the difficulty of earning a living in order to get those things which give pleasure. And then, as the Buddha goes on in the next verse, if no property comes to the clansman while he works and strives and makes an effort, he sorrows, grieves and laments. He weeps, crying, beating his breast and becomes distraught, crying, my work is in vain, my effort is fruitless. Now, this too is a danger. So you work hard and you still don't get what you want. But that's not it. That's not the end of it. If property comes to the clansman while he works and strives and makes an effort thus, he still experiences pain and grief in protecting it. How shall neither kings nor thieves make off with my property, nor fire burn it, nor water sweep it away, nor hateful heirs make off with it? And as he guards and protects his property, kings or thieves make off with it, or fire burns it, or water sweeps it away, or hateful heirs make off with it, and he sorrows, grieves and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught, crying, what had I have no longer. Now this too is a danger. So if we get what we want, then there's still a danger. There's still the danger that it's going to be lost or worn out, or tax is going to eat into our super, or whatever it is we think that we've got to protect against. So there's no end with this pursuit of sensual pleasure, because the pleasure that arises dependent on those sense objects is not permanent. It's temporary. It changes. If it was permanent, we wouldn't have to go and eat it again. We wouldn't have to go and get another one. We'd just be satisfied with what we've got. Then if we go and get it and work hard, we may not be able to accomplish what we want to accomplish. And then if we do, we have to work hard to protect it. And so this is the danger in sensual pleasures, that there's this constant chasing after. But there's also this, as it says here, these things are connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. So it's not only that they are conditioning the pursuit of sensuality right here and now in order to get this thing or that thing, but they feed the underlying tendency to greed and hatred, and also to delusion if we chase after these things still under the delusion that when I get this thing, I'll be happy. Now, I've just got to earn another 200,000 and put that away, and then I won't have any worries left until I... the next time. A cartoon that I saw recently was the doctor saying to someone, oh, you're really healthy, you'll live till you're 90. And the person saying, I've only got super till I'm 70. He was miserable because he had a good bill of health. See, the dilemma that we find ourselves in, that it's never a solution to the problem that we face in trying to look after this body and satisfy our desires. And so the danger in sensual pleasures, which the Buddha's teaching points to again and again, is that however successful we are in satisfying our sensual desires now, it's never going to be ultimately fulfilling. It's never going to be a permanent satisfaction. And in fact, the more successful we are and the more effort we put into accomplishing these ends, the more we are feeding the underlying tendency to greed, hatred and delusion. So that's really the danger, that we can be successful and think that this is it, and our delusion is even stronger until we are faced with the situation where everything that we've worked so hard for is swept away, ruined by some catastrophe. Or at the end of this life, we find that we've worked so hard and put all our effort into accumulating things which we just have to leave behind. The other thing that happens is that we accumulate all these things with the idea that it's for my family, it's for my children, it's for my this or for my that, and those people don't appreciate what we've done. And so if we make our success dependent on what other people think, how other people feel gratified in what we've done, then there's also likely to be disappointment. And it's very often not till we're at the point where we see that we have to leave these things behind that we then question why we've spent so much time and effort in accumulating these things which have ultimately been unfulfilling. Now, this is why in this particular teaching the Buddha talks about those recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is that there is no harm in sensual pleasures. And the Buddha's teaching was that there is some happiness to be gained from sensuality, but ultimately that is not where fulfillment is to be found. And if we don't realize that, we can waste a lot of time pursuing sensual pleasure and actually increasing the tendency to pursue sensual pleasure and not ever realize the danger, and never get to the point where we seek to escape from the bond of sensual desire. And so the simile which he gives of the creeper overtaking the tree is a very apt simile, because at the beginning this soft little downy tendril of the creeper feels quite pleasant, and it's a companion for the tree, companion planting. You know, I've got this little friend who's here growing up around me, isn't it nice? And then slowly that little creeper gets stronger and stronger, until it takes over the whole tree, and then it finally destroys the tree. And so this is what we see with sensuality and sensual desire, the pursuit of sensual pleasure. And so this is where we see this is pleasant now, pursuing these sensual pleasures, but it leads to suffering in the end, not only because there is no lasting fulfillment, but also because it reinforces our dependence on sensual pleasure for our well-being. So it creates the conditions for our life, in this life itself, but also for future life, where we're still very bound to sensuality. Are there any questions or comments on any of that? Yes, so that's a very good point. basically this teaching is giving the worst end result scenario. So the teaching is saying that because of the desire for sensual pleasure, people will do all sorts of things. And in this particular teaching, the Buddha doesn't go into the that aspect so much. In the following sutta, which is the longer discourse on the ways of undertaking things, this Buddha teaches these four ways specifically in relation to the fact that people act in immoral and unvirtuous ways in order to fulfill their sensual desires. And that is the result that leads, or the cause that leads to rebirth in hell. So this is just giving the worst case scenario, that people will, in their desperation to be successful, break the five precepts, and that will end in their an unfavorable rebirth. So because I'm always seem to overrun the time, I thought we would not look at both suttas today, we just look at the one sutta. But perhaps next time we'll look at the following sutta, which goes into more detail about the sila aspect. So obviously all of us are pursuing sensual pleasures, so that the pursuit of sensual pleasure is not in itself a cause for rebirth in the hell realms, but it's the means that we use to satisfy our sensual desires and the things that we get up to, harming ourselves and harming others, that result in that kind of rebirth. And it's also, as I said, this not only in the present moment that we are pursuing, but it reinforces that underlying tendency to greed and hatred. And so it makes it harder for us to extricate ourselves, to find alternative means to find satisfaction. So we go on to verse 5. And what bhikkhus is the way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain? Here bhikkhus, someone goes naked, rejecting conventions, licking his hands, not coming when asked, not stopping when asked. And we just go to Sutta 12, where the Buddha outlines these ascetic practices which he in himself practiced. Such was my asceticism, Sariputta, this is verse 45 in sutta number 12, that I went naked, rejecting conventions, licked my hands, not coming when asked, not stopping when asked. I did not accept food brought or food specially made or an invitation to a meal. I received nothing from a pot, from a bowl, across a threshold, across a stick, across a pestle, across from two people eating together, from a pregnant woman, from a woman giving suck, from a woman lying with a man, from where food was advertised to be distributed, from where a dog was waiting, from where flies were buzzing. I accepted no fish or meat. I drank no liquor, wine or fermented brew. I kept to one house, to one morsel. I kept to two houses, to two morsels. I kept to seven houses, to seven morsels. I lived on a saucerful a day, on two saucerfuls a day, on seven saucerfuls a day. I took food once a day, once every 2 days, once every 7 days, and so on up to once every fortnight. I dwelt pursuing the practice of taking food at stated intervals. I was an eater of greens or millet or wild rice or hide parings or moss or rice bran or rice scum or sesame flour or grass or cow dung. I lived on forest roots and fruits. I fed on fallen fruits. I clothed myself in hemp mixed cloth, in shrouds, in refuse rags, in tree bark, in antelope hide, in strips of antelope hide, in kusa grass fabric, in bark fabric, in wood shavings fabric, in head hair wool, in animal wool, in owl's wings. I was one who pulled out hair and beard, pursuing the practice of pulling out hair and beard. I was one who stood continuously rejecting seats. I was one who squatted continuously, devoted to maintaining the squatting position. I was one who used a mattress of spikes. I made a mattress of spikes my bed. I dwelt pursuing the practice of bathing in water 3 times daily, including the evening. Thus, in such a variety of ways, I dwelt pursuing the practice of tormenting and mortifying the body. Such was my asceticism. So the Buddha's describing that he practiced all sorts of asceticisms, and that he knew what these asceticisms were. And he's now saying that there are ways of undertaking things that are painful now and ripen in the future as pain. And he talks about all these conventions. Such is the variety of ways he dwells pursuing the practice of tormenting and mortifying the body. And then on the dissolution of the body after death, that person appears in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. This is called the way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain. Now, I mentioned that we need to take this teaching in the context of the time and place, and particularly of the teachings that were around at the time of the Buddha, and which the Buddha himself had tried out. And during the course of his 6 years of striving, after he left home and first of all practiced meditation with 2 teachers and then took up the ascetic practices, this was an attempt to gain control of the mind by subduing the body. And the theory was that if you could subdue the body by not indulging it and not looking after it, if you starved it of food, if you didn't give it any comfort, then eventually that by being able to take such ruthless control over the body, that the mind would then be at peace. And the Buddha, through his own practice, experienced that what happened was that even though he had put forth tireless energy and had unremitting mindfulness, that because of the strain on his body, that his mind was very unpeaceful and was not able to attain a state of clarity where he could develop insight. And in the course of his teaching, after he had become enlightened, he was often approached by wanderers from other sects who pursued these sorts of practices and who questioned him about whether he was really enlightened and able to talk about enlightenment, because he didn't seem to be doing what was called developing the body. And that means that he wasn't pursuing these ascetic practices, which were considered to be the hallmark of those who were really serious about enlightenment. And when he asked these wanderers what they meant by spirit, by development of the body, they would talk about these ascetic practices. And when he further questioned them, they very often told him that for periods of time they would pursue these very strong ascetic practices until their body was unable to sustain them any longer, and then they would revert to eating food and looking after the body and until their body was well again, and then they would take up these ascetic practices again. And this is how they what they considered to be development of the body. And the Buddha because he had done that sort of practice, knew that that was not a fruitful kind of practice, because what was being, if you like, pursued at one time was then given up, and one would revert to sensual pleasure. One would resort again to looking after the body and indulging the body. And he pointed out to these spiritual practitioners who would come and question him about whether or not he was qualified to give teachings because he didn't practice these. He asked them what was the development that they did of the mind. And they were never able to give an exposition of how these ascetic practices actually allowed them to develop their mind into any level of either calm or insight. And so the Buddha pointed out when discussing with these practitioners that they were torturing the body here and now, and because they had no calm or wisdom with which to deal with what was happening with their body, that there would be constant aversion being created. I'm sorry, can you take the little child out, please, because it's a disturbance for everyone who's trying to listen to the class. Thank you. While they were trying to deal with the painful and feelings that arose through these ascetic practices, they were not developing their mind to any state of calm or tranquility where they were able to deal with the painful feelings that were produced. And because they had no insight into the nature of the body and the painful feelings that were being produced, their mind was overwhelmed again and again by the feelings of aversion, sometimes just aversion to this body, seeing this body as the source of all troubles, and on the other hand, seeing that this body was a source of pain because of the way that they were treating the body. There was no recognition of the mind as the place where the aversion to the body was resting. It wasn't the body itself, it was the mind in relation to the body. And this is how the Buddha talked about the pursuit of these ascetic practices being painful now and leading to pain in the future. So if you think about the first one, it's pleasant now and painful in the future because the underlying tendency to lust, to desire, is being reinforced again and again. In this particular one, it's painful now and painful in the future because the underlying tendency to ill will is being reinforced again and again. And in both cases, the underlying tendency to delusion is being reinforced again and again because one doesn't see the way out, one doesn't see the escape. So in terms of how we relate this to our practice in the present, when we look around at the way that the body is presented today and the way that happiness is presented today in our modern culture, we see how much emphasis there is on getting the body beautiful and keeping the body fit and stopping the body from aging and making the body what you'd like the body to be. This delusion again that the body is the source of our problems. And of course, if you have a sick body, an unhealthy body, a body which doesn't function, yes, you're perhaps limited in what you can enjoy in life or accomplish in life. But the Buddha's teaching emphasizes again and again that the mind is the master, and that it's learning to understand the mind and to take control of the mind, where that is where our true happiness lies. And so if you think about painful now and painful in the future, just the fact that we put so much emphasis on the body and that we think that it's worth no pain, no gain kind of thing, you can see how we're still caught up in that kind of delusion even today. Not to say that we are thinking that by torturing the body that's going to help us to take control, but there is this tremendous emphasis on having the body just the right way, and then we'll be happy. But if we pursue that practice and we are constantly arousing ill will towards the body, aversion towards this body, and getting overwhelmed by the unpleasant feelings that come through torturing the body, then the mind gets more and more unsettled. And if we reinforce that tendency again and again, then the worst result is that it ripens in the pain of a hellish rebirth. I'll go on to just elaborate on that a little bit more after the next section. But are there any questions with that? Yes, that's a very good question. Yes. The attachment to the body, basically, the attachment to material things, because the state of an unhappy destination often refers to, or the state of deprivation, unhappy destination in perdition. These are the spirit realms, the realms, for example, of the hungry ghosts. And the hungry ghosts are described as having very small mouths and very narrow necks and very big stomachs. And they can never be satisfied. They never get enough to eat. And this sort of the body, which is always tortured by never getting enough of what it wants. This is related very much to the mind state of never being able to enjoy things, never being satisfied, never perhaps being generous with sharing or making it possible for other people to enjoy things. And so this is the result of that sort of life and that sort of mind state at the time of death. Rebirth in the unhappy destinations are also the animal realms, where there's a constant search for food, very often competition with other beings, other species, very much being part of the food chain, so it's eat or be eaten, those sorts of things. Also, attachment to one's physical body in this life and the physical material condition of one's life, one's property, one's possessions, one's status, whatever those things are, that one identifies so strongly with those things as being who we are, that at the time of death we can't let go. So that attachment keeps us bound to something which has already passed away. So in the case of this body, that it's already dissolved, it's already fallen apart, but we attach or identify so much to that body as who we are and the things that that body has been enjoying, that we can't let go at the time of death. So it's in both cases attachment to either what was pleasant or attachment to what we identify with as mine, as me, that makes it difficult to let go
and therefore we are born in a state where we are often still attached mentally to those things, and that can lead to rebirth in the ghostly realms, the spirit realms. So even if you don't have a sense of, well, I don't really buy all that, just the idea of being bound to this constant treadmill of trying to get that last final thing that's going to make it happiness be here, that's going to be satisfying. And then the idea of just identifying with this body as ultimately who we are, when we see over and over again how fragile this body is, how out of control this body is, it doesn't really do what we want, and how can it be ultimately who we are when it's constantly changing out of our control. So we go on to verse 6. And what, bhikkhus, is the way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure? Here, bhikkhus, someone by nature has strong lust, and he constantly experiences pain and grief born of lust. By nature he has strong hate, and he constantly experiences pain and grief born of hate. By nature he has strong delusion, and he constantly experiences pain and grief born of delusion. Yet in pain and grief, weeping with tearful face, he leads the perfect and pure holy life. On the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. This is called the way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure. So remembering that the Buddha's talking about beginning spiritual teachers who teach one way of practice, now he goes to elaborate on those who follow the holy life which he has set out. But we shouldn't take it as meaning just monks, and we shouldn't take it as meaning just males. This is all of us who are practicing. And that experiences pain and grief born of lust does not mean just sexual desire. It means sensual desire, the sensual desire for any kind of experience through the senses, but preferably those experiences which lead to pleasure. And the strong hate, pain and grief born of hate, this doesn't mean just the strongest kind of negative emotion. It means every nuance of dislike, any sense of preference about the way things should be. And that strong delusion underlies all of this, the pain and the grief that gives delusion gives rise to. And if you think about this in terms of the monastic life, then you know that in the monastic life there's a whole body of rules that monks and nuns live by, and those rules are based on renunciation, and they give rise to restraint, and they support development of mindfulness. And so that's how we should look on this for any spiritual practitioner to undertake this path. It requires renunciation, it requires restraint and the cultivation of wholesome qualities, and it relies on the development of mindfulness so that we can start to be aware of our thought, speech and action, to see what our behaviour patterns are, what our automatic reactions are, and start to rein in those which are based on greed, those which are fueling hatred, and to start to use the guidelines of keeping the five precepts and of cultivating their positive equivalents to help to direct our thought, speech and action in the way of reducing greed, reducing hatred and seeing more clearly how delusion underlies our habit patterns. And so for any spiritual practitioner, these things are necessary. And as we first of all appreciate the goal of freedom from our impulses, freedom from the things that hurt, freedom from looking for our happiness in the places that can never give happiness, we understand that to pursue that goal, we have to undertake training. We have to develop inner discipline. And that inner discipline has to initially be based on some sort of confidence that this is worth doing and this is the way to do it. But then there has to be this inner knowing that this is beneficial, that this is actually taking me where I want to go. And so even though it's difficult to do, even though renunciation hurts, even though restraint sometimes isn't possible because our impulses are so strong and we find ourselves overwhelmed by those impulses, and then we have to recollect ourselves again, re-establish our mindfulness, this can be painful. We see not only how we're overwhelmed, but we also see the consequences of not being able to control those impulses again and again. Even though we see that, and even though we have to bear with the pain of not being able to take control completely of our thoughts, speech and action, still we persist. And even though we have a tearful face because of all that pain and grief, weeping with a tearful face, we continue to lead the perfect and pure holy life. So this means that we continue to pursue this practice even though it is difficult. And so it is painful now, but it ripens in the future as pleasure. And the future doesn't mean the next life. The future means as we continue to practice just the next moment, we might have the feeling of satisfaction that we've been able to say no to an impulse, or we've been able to bear with the painful feeling without getting miserable about it. And so there's a sense of spiritual happiness, happiness that comes from within at being able to pursue these practices and live this life. And so the future is the next moment. But as these moments accumulate, our future in this life becomes happier, and then we have created the conditions for even more happiness in the next life. Are there any... Hugh? Yes, intention is very important, because that's what we have to keep coming back to and reminding ourselves of what our goal is. That's where we're heading to, and where we're coming from. Basically, why we want to head to that is because we've started to understand a little more about what causes our happiness and our unhappiness. And then our intention, our desire, our wish is to go in the direction of greater happiness. So we need to keep re-establishing our intention to lead the holy life or to follow this spiritual path. And so if we're clear about that, even when we fall off the path in the sense of not living up to our standards, we, as soon as we know that, it's simply a point of re-establishing our intention to go in that direction, to walk in the direction of freedom. There can be anguish, but then as we develop this path, there is more equanimity. The anguish very often arises, yes, we see how we've not been able to fulfill our commitments, or we have identified with the mistake we've made as being an indication that it's impossible for us to do this, so we identify with it, and that gives rise to anguish. But as we our understanding deepens, we get more and more a sense of it's not me, it's not mine, it's not who I am that's made this ultimate mistake, that this is just another way in which ignorance and the conditions come together to produce a behaviour or a speech or whatever that is not in accordance with Dharma, not in accordance with what we want to do with our life. So there is this anguish at seeing, but that anguish becomes less and less something that we beat ourselves over the head with and take personally. Even though it's hard to do, we don't say, well, we can't do it, I can't do it. We just realise that it is a challenging path. So I'd just like to elaborate a little bit on something which the Buddha gave in the discourse to Satchika. Satchika was one of the wanderers who came to the Buddha and talked to him about this idea of ascetic practices being essential to the holy life, to the spiritual path. And the Buddha was pointing out to him that this was not considered to be development of the body in the Buddha's dispensation. And not only that, it wasn't a path that led to the development of the mind, which was really essential. And so in that particular sutta, the Buddha gives a very good, clear understanding of the difference between the other spiritual paths and the Buddhist path of practice. And it comes back to understanding what we need to do if we're going to work with things that are painful now but which can become pleasant in the future. So I'm referring now to Sutta number 36, the Maha Satchika Sutta, and to verse 8. And in this particular verse, the Buddha talks about how one is undeveloped in body and undeveloped in mind, and goes on to talk about how one is developed in body and developed in mind. And he's particularly focusing on the feelings that arise through sensual sense contact, and the feelings that arise which are pleasant or unpleasant. So verse 8, so Satchika's name is Agivesana, and this is what this verse 8 says. This is the Buddha talking. How, Agivesana, is one undeveloped in body and undeveloped in mind? Here, Agivesana, pleasant feeling arises in an untaught ordinary person. Touched by that pleasant feeling, he lusts after pleasure and continues to lust after pleasure. That pleasant feeling of his ceases. With the cessation of the pleasant feeling, painful feeling arises. Touched by that painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. When that pleasant feeling has arisen in him, it invades his mind and remains, because body is not developed. And when that painful feeling has arisen in him, it invades his mind and remains, because mind is not developed. Anyone in whom in this double manner, arisen pleasant feeling invades his mind and remains, because body is not developed, and arisen painful feeling invades his mind and remains because mind is not developed, is thus undeveloped in body and undeveloped in mind. Now that may seem all double Dutch to you, but this is a very important point, and a very important point for seeing the danger in sensuality and the way of dealing with unpleasant feelings in the Buddha's dispensation. Pleasant feeling arises in an untaught ordinary person. Touched by that pleasant feeling, he lusts after pleasure and continues to lust after pleasure. Now that is the pleasant feeling born of sensuality, of sensual pleasure. And this is what I was talking about before in the first section, where it's not only the pursuit of sensual pleasure right here and now, but because it strengthens the underlying tendency to pursuit of sensuality. There is not only the pleasant feeling that rises now, he lusts after pleasure and continues to lust after pleasure. Now, the next section, very important, that pleasant feeling of his ceases, as all feelings do, and with the cessation of the pleasant feeling, painful feeling arises. Now, this is a very important point. The cessation of pleasant feeling is unpleasant. When pleasant feeling is present, it is pleasant. And when our painful feeling, when our pleasant feeling finishes, the absence of that pleasant feeling is then perceived as painful. The ending of pleasant feeling then becomes painful. And that's why we have to keep going into getting the next thing and doing the next thing. That when that pleasant feeling finishes, something's wrong. And we have to go and do something else. Touched by that painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. When that pleasant feeling has arisen in him, it invades his mind and remains because body is not developed. Now, body is not developed in the Buddha's dispensation means that one doesn't have insight into the impermanence and conditioned nature of pleasant feelings. That one expects the pleasant feeling that has arisen because of something nice to last. Or one expects that the pleasant feeling that has arisen because we've managed to get something is my pleasant feeling to hang on to forever and ever. Now I've done it. Now I've got it. I've arrived. So being undeveloped in body means that one doesn't realize the true nature of all feelings, that they arise dependent on causes and conditions. They stay for a while, but they have the nature to change and to cease. And this is why, with delusion underlying our experience and not seeing clearly that when pleasant feeling ceases, when pleasant feeling arises, we like it. We not only like it now, but we want it to last. And because it doesn't last, the next thing is we want to bring it back again. We want to make it happen next time. We want to make it happen in the next moment. And that's why the underlying tendency to lust is strengthened. Because its nature is to fade. And because of delusion, we think something's wrong. We don't understand. This is the nature of these feelings. And so in delusion, we pursue that pleasant feeling again. And so we strengthen the underlying tendency to lust. And that's what keeps us bound. And when painful feeling has arisen, it invades his mind and remains because mind is not developed. Now, in this context, in this way of talking, the Buddha says that being developed in mind means that one has access to a state of mind, a pleasant state of mind, that is not dependent on sensuality, that is dependent on the development of one's mind in meditation. And if one has access to that, then neither pleasant feeling nor painful feeling, when it arises in the mind, invades the mind and remains and pushes one into action to maintain the pleasant feeling so that painful feeling doesn't arise. And you can see, while we are constantly in this spiral of painful feeling following on the ending of pleasant feeling and trying to make the pleasant feeling come again, and then painful feeling coming because the pleasant feeling has ended, that there's this constant going round and round in a circle. There's no way out of that, because constantly we're reinforcing the tendency to the underlying tendency to lust and the underlying tendency to aversion and the underlying tendency to ignorance. Now the next verse, verse 9, is the Buddha's exposition of this. How Agivesana is one developed in body and developed in mind? Here, Agivesana, pleasant feeling arises in a well-taught, noble disciple. Touched by that pleasant feeling, he does not lust after pleasure or continue to lust after pleasure. That pleasant feeling of his ceases. With the cessation of the pleasant feeling, painful feeling arises. Now notice that the Buddha's not saying that in the well-taught disciple, painful feeling doesn't arise, but painful feeling arises. Touched by that painful feeling, he does not sorrow, grieve and lament. He does not weep, beating his breast and become distraught. When that pleasant feeling has arisen in him, it does not invade his mind and remain, because body is developed. He knows it is impermanent. And when that painful feeling has arisen in him, it does not invade his mind and remain, because mind is developed. He has access to state of being that is not dependent on sensual contact to give rise to sensual pleasure in order for there to be a pleasant state of being. There is the development of the mind in meditation so that there is a pleasant abiding that is accessible, so that painful feeling does not remain. One can escape from those painful feelings, but one also knows the nature of all feelings, and so because of that wisdom, that one does not get overwhelmed when painful feelings arise. Are there any questions? So bringing it back to the level of feeling is actually where we need to go if we're going to escape from this pursuit of pleasure and this resistance to pain. So in one who is leading the holy life with a tearful face and in pain and grief, it is the development of this two-pronged attack, if you like, these of both calm and insight that allows one to sustain oneself in the holy life, even if it isn't a bed of roses, constantly pleasant. And if one is able to do that little by little, then it's painful now, but one produces the condition for pleasure in the future. And future doesn't mean just the next life. It means right here and now. And so we get... Sorry.
You talk about bed of roses, the thorns in the roses. Yes, the thorns in the roses, yes. So the thorns are the things that keep us awake, keep us on our toes, not giving up. If we come to a place where it's just very pleasant, then unless we have wisdom, we're just going to get lost in that pleasure. So the last section, verse 7, back to the shorter discourse on the way of undertaking things. And what bhikkhus is the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure? Here, bhikkhu, someone by nature does not have strong lust, and he does not constantly experience pain and grief born of lust. By nature, he does not have strong hate, and he does not constantly experience pain and grief born of hate. By nature, he does not have strong delusion, and he does not constantly experience pain and grief born of delusion. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters and abides in the first jhana. With the stilling of applied and sustained thought, he enters upon and abides in the second jhana. With the fading away as well of rapture, he enters upon and abides in the third jhana. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, he enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana. On the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. This is called the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure. These bhikkhus are the four ways of undertaking things. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So this fourth section is really an elaboration on the path of practice that the Buddha outlined. The middle way. And the middle way is the middle way between pursuit of sensuality and the pursuit of torture of the body. It is neither overindulging in sensuality, nor is it punishing the body and engaging in a lifestyle that is full of hardship, because the Buddha understood from his own experience that that just leaves the mind stressed and strained and not able to attain the state of peacefulness and clarity, of coming together, that is necessary for insight, deep insight to arise. And so through understanding, and this is really the basis of all this, is understanding wisdom, to see the limitations in sensual pleasure. To see the limitations in torturing the body and thinking that by subduing the body that we can overcome desire. And to see that by a combination of understanding and then cultivating this inner peacefulness, that we can start to cultivate an inner refuge which allows us to go deeper and deeper into the mind itself, eventually through these deep absorptions to put the body aside and to work with the mind directly. And through accomplishing those states, the jhanas, to be able to see things as they really are. But one needs to have a vantage point, if you like, that is above the world, apart from the normal way of things, so that one can see things in a different way. In order to get to that point, one has to gradually become less dependent on the senses and the gratification possible through the senses. One has to become less dependent on the worldly way of achieving happiness. And then one has to develop that insight which sees that even when happiness is possible through successfully pursuing sensual pleasure, that happiness by its nature is always only going to be temporary, because the nature of all feeling is to be temporary and to change. And that when it changes, gives rise to painful. The absence of that pleasure is unsatisfactory. So it may not be painful in that we go, ouch, but there's a certain disturbance in the mind when that pleasure has subsided. And that's why we then look for the next thing that we can have or do to make those pleasant feelings re-arise. And while ever we're caught in that, we're going to be constantly strengthening that tendency. Not only the tendency to lust and hatred, but the ignorance that underpins it all. So if we want to be able to come to the last section, the last way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in pleasure in the future, we have to gradually start to discipline ourselves and train ourselves to move in the direction of letting go of dependence on sensuality, and also working to strengthen the mind in the positive qualities of loving kindness, all the wholesome states which allow us to be less reactive to feeding the underlying tendency to ill will, aversion and hatred. So are there any questions? Yes. Yes, explaining neutral feeling and upekkha. Well, upekkha is mentioned in several different contexts. So in terms of the seven factors of enlightenment, upekkha is the culmination of the spiritual practice, because in that accomplishment, no feeling, no matter how pleasant or how painful, moves the mind, and that is the state of ultimate equanimity of the arahat. When painful feelings arise, they're simply observed as painful feelings. When pleasant feelings arise, they're simply observed as pleasant feelings, but there's no identification with them, no grasping at them. So that is the ultimate in equanimity. The other kind of equanimity which is mentioned is the sort of platform of calm, of clarity in the mind, which is the onlooking equanimity, which is able to see things as they are arising and playing themselves out and changing without getting caught up in the process as it's happening. So it's the equanimity of a mindfulness, which is able to be present and see things. Then we talk about equanimity in the four Brahma Viharas, and that is more an emotional state where one has this boundless goodwill and this boundless compassion and this boundless joy in the happiness of others in an unreserved way for all beings everywhere. So it's an equanimity that is without conditions and without selecting out just particular groups or particular situations, that one's emotional state is all-encompassing, if you like, but it's also very balanced, because the other aspect of equanimity is that one knows the truth of conditionality and cause and effect, and one knows the laws of karma, and so one knows that what beings are the heirs of their karma, and so whatever comes along one accepts, because there must be a cause for it. It's not just happening out of nowhere. So one is equanimous even when beings are suffering, there's compassion, but there's also an understanding that this is beings are the heirs to their karma, basically. So there's an equanimity that allows one to act and do what needs to be done or can be done without getting overwhelmed. So that's another kind of equanimity. So the neutral feeling which arises, neutral feeling is often associated with ignorance or not knowing, because it's neither pleasant, so that we take notice of it, or painful, so that we take notice of it. We usually only take notice of feelings that have a bite in either direction. Either they're very pleasant or they're very painful. And all the other feelings, which are neither of those, we are just ignorant of. So, for example, when we're just sitting here, if there's nothing happening in our chest area, we don't even know that we've got a chest because our attention is somewhere else. But if we start to get a pain in our chest, we'll forget about everything else and our whole attention will be on that painful feeling. So neutral feeling can be anything that's neither pleasant nor painful and doesn't grab our attention. But as our mindfulness increases, we start to be able to be aware of much more subtle level of feeling. They're neither strongly this or strongly that. They may be less pleasant and less painful, but we still notice them. And then as our equanimity increases, we're able to see them all much more as one thing, because we all know that all painful feeling is impermanent, arises out of conditions, is not me, not mine, not a self. Pleasant feeling is arising out of conditions, is impermanent, is not me, not mine, not a self. And neutral feeling is likewise. So feelings, the equanimity that is connected with feelings is that one is very balanced with whatever is present. But one's sharpness of mind means that one is more aware of every kind of feeling that arises. And then as one becomes more balanced, neutral feeling becomes pleasant. That's basically what happens, is neutral feeling is then perceived as pleasant. Because neutral feeling is just feeling, and the more that the mind is able to focus in, the more that one feels those subtle feelings, the more that one can be with them with an equanimous mind, the more pleasant they become. So when we do walking meditation, for example, and our mind is very focused, walking becomes very blissful. Not because suddenly walking has changed, but because we're now able to focus in moment by moment, sensation by sensation, and what seemed ordinary is actually perceived quite differently. So as the mind settles down and becomes more pure, I suppose, more less distracted, the neutral feeling becomes pleasant. So if we have neutral feeling is pleasant, we no longer have to pursue sensual pleasure for pleasant feeling to arise. We have a pleasant feeling already at our fingertips just with ordinary everyday activities. And so we're in a much more buoyant frame of mind just in ordinary life. So we don't feel that impulse to go and get something nice, which is the pull to sensuality. It's a sensual pleasures. So it's a more refined sensual pleasure that we stay with neutral feeling. It's still sensual pleasure because it's still something that is experienced through the senses and through contact, but it is much more fulfilling and sustaining for us, so we don't feel as though we have to go and get something big to happen to make us feel happy and at ease. And that's actually the direction this path goes in. So when you look at monastics and you think that they have a miserable time because they can't do this and can't do that and they have only to wear the same robes every day and they can't do... Actually, it's all part of the bliss package that goes along with this path. But it doesn't look like that from the outside and it doesn't feel like that from the inside unless when you're practicing, then it starts to make sense. Emotional numbing and absent-minded, an expression of neutral feeling. No, that's lack of clarity. It's not that one doesn't feel... it's that one is not moved. One doesn't feel the same extremes that one felt before. So emotion is still there because there is compassion and there is loving kindness. There is ability to rejoice in the happiness of others. That actually gets stronger because there's no vested interest in it. You're not selecting out just some people and some things. You can celebrate all sorts of things because there's less of a barrier between yourself and others. But the intensity of it in terms of to do with me is less. You're not sort of looking to that feeling to give you a high. It just comes and it goes. Does it come down to lack of attachment? Yes, that's a very important component of it. And that's where we start to see how we are attached and clinging on, but very often it's through lack of wisdom, lack of understanding. And so it's a freedom one sees rather than that one is struggling with something that's terrible. It's not that sort of battle, because when the attachments start to diminish, the happiness grows, and so you've got something there as a replacement. But it's not that you're making that thing bad or wrong, but you can see how you were taking it up wrongly. You were misunderstanding its nature or what it could offer you. Yes. Yes. Right. The question is regarding the simile of the tree that has the creeper growing around it, and the sutta says that the deva felt pain. The way that we understand it is that the tree deva lives in the tree, not that the deva is the tree. And it feels painful because its home is being ruined. Its place, its abode is being destroyed. And that's the pain that comes from loss of one's living space. There is, from this sutta and from many other places where the Buddha talks to beings who aren't human beings but who are beings who inhabit a realm very close to the human realm, there is an understanding that there are beings living in big trees and around places, and that is the place where they abide. So it's their home that's being lost. There's not the same sense that the trees themselves are animated with a consciousness in the same way that human beings or other beings in the higher realms have a consciousness. So, for example, when the Buddha talked about the Bodhi tree, he didn't talk about the Bodhi tree as a living being with a consciousness in the same way as he talked to other beings, but he had great gratitude for the shelter that he received from the Bodhi tree. Yes, Tom. That he does not have strong lust or doesn't have strong hate, that sort of thing. Suppressing the five hindrances is the first part of verse 7, a simile for that, or referring to that. Definitely the five hindrances need to be suppressed for the mind to develop in meditation, but I think it's talking, I'm glad you brought that up because I didn't actually speak on that. These being people who are born with less strong lust and less strong hate and whatever, this goes back to what I was saying about how if we pursue sensual pleasures that we reinforce the underlying tendencies to greed, hatred and delusion, or to lust, hatred and delusion. And if we practice so that we don't keep reinforcing those underlying tendencies, then gradually they diminish. And then when we are reborn, and to be reborn in a favourable realm, it's not just the heavenly realm, but the human realm where we can practice, that we're people who are born with less of those qualities of greed, hatred and delusion. And so, you know, all of us here taking up this spiritual path, you know, giving up Sunday afternoon to come and listen to the Buddha's teaching and to pursue this practice. We're all, you know, following this path by choice and see something in it and find it sufficiently valuable to give it time and energy. So compare. We mightn't feel like we compare with the Buddha, for example, but if we compare ourselves with many other people who are here, who are living in the same society that we're in, we're just quite different from them because we have less greed, less hatred, less delusion. We may still have those greed, hatred and delusion triggered if the conditions are right, so someone comes to attack us or whatever, but generally speaking, we aren't driven by them to the same extent that many other people are, even just, you know, if you look at people around us today. So you can see that there are differences, and so that's what the Buddha's saying. If you cultivate these things, that the result is going to be for your benefit. And it can be even in this life, because if we look at ourselves, we can say, well, I've got less greed than I had when I was before I started practicing, or that part of what I can see is that I've got less hatred now than when I started practicing, or I've understood things now that I just didn't realise before. So already there's a development in the direction we want to go. So, I mean, even to talk to people about the fact that there's a happiness to be found that's apart from sensual pleasure. You know, some people just could, not that they don't even want to hear it, it just is unfathomable for them. I mean, what are you talking about? Crazy. So you can see that, you know, there are differences in people. So I think if there are no more questions, we'll just end by sharing the merits. So as I chant the verse to share the merits, please mentally chant it and share the merits that you've made through being here this afternoon. May the merits made by me now or at some other time, be shared among all beings here, infinite, immeasurable. By rejoicing in this cause, this gift of merits given by me, may beings all forever live a happy life, be free from hate, and may they find the path secure, and their good wishes all succeed.
Thank you.